sword away from the priest, he carefully extended it again for examination.
Thank you. Dominion of knowledge, evaluate the intensity of this effect.
The priest extended the wand into the sword's aura, and, as Talion had anticipated, a flash of blue sparks erupted on contact. When the skinny man instinctively withdrew the metallic rod, the once rounded end of the rod had been shorn off into a flat edge. There was no sign of the missing metal. It had been cleanly disintegrated.
By all the gods, the priest mumbled. I don't even understand what that was.
Talion nodded sagely. Can I sheathe this now? The knowledge sorcerer nodded absently, still staring at the wand. Get anything useful? The priest of Cytira bit his lip.
This spell measures the intensity of other spell effects in standardized units, which we call domini, after the word dominion. A typical offensive spell effect has an intensity of between 30 and 80 domini. An expert sorcerer, a specialist in a particular dominion, might manage 2 to 3 times that. People claim to have measured Hardigan's fire spells at over 600 domini.
I take it the aura measured higher than you expected?
Well, I didn't see a number at all. More like a string of incomprehensible letters. I have to assume that the measuring spell didn't function properly since the rod suffered catastrophic damage when it came into contact with the aura.
Talion chuckled. No, letters instead of numbers sounds about right to me. The priest frowned.
I don't really know what to say to that. I'll have to bring you a prop to serve as a functional replacement for this scenario, but it won't be anywhere near as potent as your sword, probably is.
That's probably for the best, thank you. The priest nodded absently and retreated from the room.
That was amazing,
Trace offered.
It really is the real thing, isn't it? Who else besides the Tales Pantheon could forge something so great?
Right. Talion patted the hilt of the sword, feeling uncertain. It's powerful, certainly, but I don't think that necessarily says anything about who made it, or, perhaps more importantly, about why it was forged in the first place. Their legends say this was a sword forged for an alliance between gods, but all it does is destroy. There's a secret there, and I don't have even a hint on where to begin to unravel it.
The priest returned a few minutes later, gingerly carrying what appeared to be an exact duplicate of his sword, scabbard and all.
Huh.
I'm sorry, it won't perform quite like the real thing, but it'll be as powerful as I could manage.
Talion accepted the false sword, noting that the weapon was significantly lighter than the real thing.
A training sword, probably reshaped with metal sorcery.
Interestingly, when he withdrew the blade, runes flared to life on the surface, all 7 of them. Frowning, Talion sheathed the false sword. Realizing he was still being observed by most of the people in the room, Talion unfastened his belt and removed the scabbard containing the actual Sekhes. He was loath to part with it, but if he was only going into the next room, he suspected the paladins here could keep watch over it for a few moments. He carefully laid it against the wall, fastening the fake sword on in its place. The minute difference in weight scratched at the back of his mind, but he offered a friendly smile to the priest regardless. It wasn't the other man's fault that sacred weapons were hard to perfectly copy on a moment's notice.
Thanks for arranging this for me.
Of course, the priest said. It was an honor to have a chance to inspect the real Sekhes. Would you mind if I take another look at it while—
Not now, Hallwell,
Trace instructed in a stern tone.
We need you to finish setting up the scenario.
Right, well, good luck in there,
the priest offered. Talion gave him a nod of thanks as the shorter man rushed back out of the room. The other people within the room gradually went back to their own conversations, and it was several more minutes before Trace left and finally returned once again.
It's time. Assume for the scenario that you're being escorted by Isharin, who met you at the gate, to meet with your opponent in the duel.
Korvax. Even when Orlan finally fell, Korvax was never defeated. In fact, the invaders picked a time when he wasn't in the city to strike. He's still alive today, as far as anyone knows, unless he died during the fall of Zixis, which somehow I find unlikely. The stories say that he killed hundreds of men with his bare hands. Now that I think about it, that might have been at this very battle. Blades broke against the plates on his skin, and arrows bounced off any part of him they struck. Only sorcery had any effect at all, so he slaughtered sorcerers as soon as he found them. My false blade, he considered, awkwardly reaching for the grip of the fake sword, might not be strong enough.
Talion was escorted by four bulky Asharin, each at least a head taller than he was. Unlike the one real Asharin he had met, these looked almost human, with ordinary skin visible between their obsidian-like plates.
I wonder what these Asharin are, he considered. People in extensive costumes are unlikely on such short notice. Perhaps they're under illusions?
While he was supposedly outdoors for the scenario, the bounds of the room were still clear. If there was a sight sorcerer making the Asharin, he hadn't bothered to make the walls or ceiling invisible. It wasn't a real problem, of course. The goal of the scenario wasn't complete immersion. They were testing his strategic abilities, and possibly his combat prowess, not his ability to act.
"Stand here, human," one of the Asharin said, leading him into a marked circle on the ground.
"A fighting ring. I can deal with that. But where's my opponent?"
The door on the opposite side of the room exploded. Talion shielded his eyes from the wood splinters as smoke cleared away from the doorway, revealing a figure tall enough to brush the room's ceiling. His skin was like polished obsidian, although the lower half of his body was covered by thick mail. He had no weapons on his belt. Instead, strands of string draped small objects that Talion recognized after a moment to be human ears.
Well, someone's feeling theatrical.
"It's a pleasure to meet the current bearer of the Sakes,"
the huge Asharin spoke, his tone rich and full of mirth.
"I've been anxious to have an artifact of my own for quite some time."
Talion gritted his teeth, stepping into his side of the circle. "I'm sorry to disappoint you, but your exposure to the weapon will be brief and probably uncomfortable. Korvax, I assume?" The big Asharin grinned, shaking his head.
"Oh, no. He's presently busy dealing with your little invisible friends. Clever, having them stand by the gates while we opened it to meet you. I wasn't expecting a human to be so canny."
Talion shrugged a shoulder.
"Well, there goes that part of my plan. Maybe." He said they knew about the spies, not that they had caught them.
"I appreciate the compliment. For what it's worth, I'm impressed by your defenses. What name should I remember you by when you're gone?"
The Zixian brought back his head and gave a deep, bellowing laugh. "You're an amusing one. I think I'll keep you around for a while, once you've been sufficiently tamed. But I'm being rude. I didn't answer your question. Cries on deck, Crown Prince of Zixis."
"Oh, Resh."
The prince appeared in front of him a moment later, leaving a burst of smoke at his previous location. Talion didn't have time to draw his sword. He just barely managed to raise his right arm in time to block the prince, slamming a fist forward with immense force, catapulting Talion across the room. He slammed into the back wall, the protective spell that had been cast on him in the preparation chamber only serving to somewhat dampen the force of the impact. A wheezing breath escaped his lungs, and then Cries on Deck was above him, bringing a fist downward. Talion pushed off of the wall, throwing himself into a roll. He had hoped to bring himself back to his feet in a single motion, but the impact had thrown him off balance, and he found himself awkwardly pushing himself from a kneeling position back to his feet. Something wrapped around his neck from behind, and Talion slammed an elbow backward. He met solid resistance, but the grip on his neck loosened, and he raised his right hand and pointed it backward. Blast! The burst of flame that emerged from his hand was largely cosmetic. He had never managed a flame spell that dealt any real damage at range. As he expected, however, the force around his neck vanished, and Kryzan appeared across the room a moment later. His opponent hadn't risked being hit by the attack, as weak as it was.
"Oh, a sorcerer too. Delightful."
The Zixian prince knelt down, his previously human-looking fingers visibly shifting into claws.
"Transformation sorcery," Talion noted. That's unusual for a Zixian. It's more common for Dalarans, but not unheard of. More importantly, it's really bad that he can do that, and also teleport. Fortunately, Talion stood up. He also gave me a chance to breathe.
The false Sakes sang as the blade scraped against the metal inside of the sheath, 7 runes flaring to life on the surface of the weapon.
"The last time I fought in Asharan," Talion said, wheezing slightly as he attempted to buy a moment of time to recover. "I beat him with my bare hands. You seem to be slightly stronger, though, so I'll offer you the respect of meeting my blade."
"You beat an Asharan bare-handed?"
The prince brought a clawed hand to his chest, looking strangely like a mockery of the paladin's salute.
"Was this a baby, fresh from drinking mother's milk?"
Do Asharan drink milk? He had never considered that before.
"No, fully grown, I'm afraid. Sadly, he lacked your skill at using sorcery to compensate for physical weakness."
"Oh, you wound me, dear human. Tell me, what name shall I inscribe upon the slave band that I will place upon your neck?"
Talion grinned, cracking his neck. "Well, the name is Solaris, but to you, the name Talion might be more appropriate. After all, that's the name of a legend that you stand no chance to defeat." The prince vanished again, but this time Talion was ready. He swept the blade out in a gleaming arc in front of him, sundering the air. Fortunately, ready did not account for all possible positions. Cries on deck descended from the sky. Talion fell backward a moment before the Zixian impacted with him, which saved him from being eviscerated by the creature's newly formed claws. Instead, he felt a burning sensation as the sorcery-altered fingers ripped through his uniform and impacted his right shoulder, just before the creature's full weight landed atop him and slammed him into the floor. His head swam, but cries on deck didn't slow. Talion barely managed to raise his left arm in time to block the next claw's swipe, and he felt a surge of agony as the barrier along his arm flickered and faltered. The Asharan grabbed at his arms next, and while Talion was nearly able to match the creature's strength, its superior leverage kept him pinned to the ground. So, unable to move his arms, Talion slammed his forehead into the Asharan's nose. Kryzon recoiled immediately, and that moment was all he needed. Talion didn't have much room to maneuver the false Sakes, but he didn't need much either. An ordinary sword's edge would have had no effect on Kryzon's scales, but when Talion ran the Sakes along the huge Asharan's chest, the aura shredded plates and the tender flesh beneath. The demon prince shoved himself off the floor, and Talion slashed as the larger man retreated, taking a gouge out of the creature's leg. The Zixian prince vanished, reappearing near the door where he had entered.
"Kill him!"
the prince ordered, vanishing again. Talion spun and rolled as he left the floor, bisecting the first Asharan in an instant. The other three froze as the two halves of the first fell to the ground. Talion brandished the glowing blade and then pointed it downward at the creature he had just slain.
"I will allow you to flee," Talion offered the three remaining guards.
They fled, exiting through the door that Kryzon had entered. After a moment, he processed what had just happened.
"I really hope I didn't just cut an actor in half. That had to be an illusion."
Talion took a deep breath, glancing around the room and realizing that he had been left alone. After a moment of checking himself for real injuries, Talion determined that he was fully intact, although his uniform's shoulder had been badly damaged. He wasn't sure if that would get him into trouble or not. Uncertain of how to proceed with this scenario, he headed for the area where Kryzon had appeared, walking to the gap where the Zixian prince had entered and slammed straight into an invisible wooden wall.
"Of course they didn't actually blow up the door," Talion realized, shaking his head. "It's just an illusion."
He heard the sound of the door he had entered from opening, and Trace walked into the room.
"You've completed this part of the scenario."
He had only the slightest hint of emotion in his tone, but he was grinning broadly.
"Come back into the waiting area."
Talion sheathed the false Sakes and followed Trace back into the previous room. Most of the judges looked up at him as he entered, giving him varying looks. He couldn't read most of them, but one of them, a younger man, gave him a nod.
"That's a good sign, right?"
"Well, that was, unusual," Trace offered. I'm afraid we're not prepared to simulate the entire city, so if you let me know what your next plans are, I'll relay them to the judges.
Before that, those four guards, they were just sight and sound sorcery effects, right?
The swordsman's right hand twitched when he thought about the possibility that he had actually just cut someone in half.
Of course they were. Only the demon prince was solid.
Trace gave him a quizzical look.
Is something wrong?
Talion shook his head. I was just disturbed by the thought that I might have just hurt an actor in a costume.
Oh, we wouldn't take that kind of risk. Don't worry about it. Are you injured at all? Looked like you took a few serious hits back there.
Doing just fine. Can I have a minute to think about the next steps in my plan?
Sure. I think it would be at least a few minutes before the Asharan sent someone else to kill you.
Right. A few main options at this point. I could try to sync up with the infiltrators and help rescue the prince. They might need the help. On the other hand, I might make things worse by attracting more attention to them. I'm not very good at stealth. I could try to go rescue the prince separately. I know the city layout relatively well, and I know the palace layout even better. I could try to follow Kryze on deck. Killing him would be a tremendous blow to the Zixian Empire as a whole, but I think I've lost my window to do that. He won't make the mistake of fighting me in melee combat again, now that I've cut him. I could try to find Korvax, but he could be practically anywhere, so that option wouldn't really work. Or I could probably get out of the city intact and report back that our infiltrators are being hunted. Maybe someone outside the walls could send help. Or maybe I'm fixating too much on taking immediate action.
I'm going to find an empty house and hide.
Trace blinked. What do you mean?
Given that the city is about to come under siege, they've probably evacuated some of the locations near the walls. Even if they haven't formally evacuated anything, I can probably just find a place to hide somewhere. I'd regret having to fight civilians if I run into any, but I could probably scare them off. I'd hide until the bombardment starts, and then once the battle is going in earnest, I'll go for the prince. If the infiltration squad already saved him, great. If not, I'll do it myself.
Okay. How long would you wait after the bombardment starts before heading to the palace?
Only a few minutes. There's the possibility that they might try to move or execute Adelin once the battle begins, especially since they know we sent in spies. It's possible he's already dead. If I find evidence of that, I'll try to take one of the Zixian royals as my own prisoner and extract him or her from the city.
Huh. Well, wouldn't have considered that. I'll go tell the judges.
Trace ran off to the judges' table, leaning down and exchanging more hushed conversation with them. He returned to Talion after several minutes.
You've given us enough to begin evaluating your test results.
Talion blinked.
Really? That's it?
Trace laughed.
Usually it's over a lot faster than that, actually. But you didn't hear that from me. And remember, no talking to any of the candidates about this until you're all done.
So, did I pass?
Trace shrugged.
No idea. The judges will need time to make a decision. But either way, you gave us a pretty impressive show.
Chapter 9 Jonan 2 Old Friends. Velthrin's winding streets were somewhat easier to navigate in the Dawnfire's light, but only slightly. The city had grown rapidly from its founding until a mere 50 years ago, when Edric Theus had laid the city's famous boundary wards, a series of protection rituals that made the walls nearly impervious to harm. The wards were broadly believed to have other functions, such as preventing teleportation into the city from outside, but Jonan didn't know the details. He did, however, notice one of the consequences. When the wards were built, the city could no longer be built outward, otherwise the wards would lose their function. From that point on, the citizens had been forced to build in other directions, upward and down. Sullair had its share of tall towers and majestic keeps, but they were few and reserved for the wealthy. Nearly every structure in Velthrin, however, was several floors tall. Individual houses were practically non-existent outside of the wealthiest areas. Those wealthy areas were easy to discern visually, but the city didn't seem to follow the same structure of clear districts that Sullair and Orlan did, at least not so far as Jonan could tell.
tall housing complexes sat directly adjacent to warehouses, restaurants, and shops. The civilians seemed to know their way around instinctively, but the servant of Alien often found himself frowning at his map, pondering what sort of madness could have led to a city so lacking in organization. It was midday before he found Orison Park, one of the few spots of green in a city of cobblestones and gray masonry. He paused to take a breath of the air nearer to the trees, hoping that the scent would remind him of the familiar forest air of home. But that effort ended in failure. The wood here had a sweet scent that struck him as unnatural, far unlike the sharpness of pine that he had grown accustomed to. He found the twisting trails within the park easier to navigate. These, at least, appeared to lead specifically to or past points of interest. He passed a large statue of Lorraine Valaire, one of the city's founders, and smiled at the children that were attempting to climb up the base. Past that, the trail led him to a pond. A group of young men were running circles around it, while a couple took turns tossing something, food perhaps, near a group of birds in the water. Passing these people by, Jonan trekked onward, finally finding his destination. A lone bench, a familiar figure sitting atop it, a book pressed close against her face. Jonan paused for a moment, uncertain what to say in spite of the hours he had spent aware of his destination. Lydia spoke first, without even looking up from the pages.
"Good morning, Jonan. Join me."
He silently took a seat by her side, and she set the book down on her lap a moment later. Instinctively, his eyes shifted to the cover of the tome as she moved.
"Reading more of Torren's work? Don't you ever get tired of it?"
Jonan had read several of Torren's works. They were practically a mandatory part of any sorcerer's education. But he found the scholar's style too informal and whimsical for his tastes.
"He's the expert on something I've been needing to study, but we'll get to that."
He nodded, glancing around. "Beautiful morning."
"Is it?"
Lydia followed his gaze and then shook her head.
"I hadn't noticed."
Truthfully, he hadn't really either, but someone else had mentioned it to him earlier, and he had long ago learned to mimic platitudes to mask his own awkwardness.
So, it's been a while." "It certainly has. Thank you for coming on such short notice. I wouldn't have asked if there wasn't a good reason."
"A good reason? I suppose just wanting to see me wasn't good enough."
"I suspected as much," he replied.
"And I was already in Velthrin, but she can't know that."
"What did you need my help with?"
She tilted her head to the side, allowing a free strand of red to fall in front of her eyes.
"A couple things, actually. First, I was hoping you'd be willing to share the results of your studies of Donovan's sorceress experiments."
Several months earlier, Jonan and Lydia had worked together to investigate Donovan Taylor, a former priest of Cytira who had set himself up as a god in the city of Orlan. They had found evidence that Donovan had discovered a new way of applying ancient sorceress techniques, which the sorcerer had used to fake his divine status. Their work had resulted in Donovan's arrest, and Jonan had managed to hold on to Donovan's cryptic research notes when they had left the city. Throughout the intervening time period, studying those notes had occupied the vast majority of Jonan's time. He had sent Lydia several messages about his progress via a Dominion-bonded hand mirror that shared images with her own matching mirror. But he had kept the notes deliberately vague, just in case Lydia had somehow lost her mirror.
"I suppose I could, but I'm not sure this is really the right place."
He looked around again, not seeing any civilians in the immediate vicinity, but knowing that he had seen people no more than a few minutes away.
"I thought of that, and there isn't really a much better location. I can't exactly bring you to the Paladin headquarters, and I sincerely doubt that wherever you're staying is secure."
"That's an understatement."
"All right, fair enough, but I'll keep it in broad terms. I don't want anyone overhearing us and piecing together secrets of world-shaking scale."
Lydia gave a scoffing chuckle.
"There's no need to be so dramatic. No one is going to be able to do anything with that information without the sufficient context to know what we're talking about."
"You're more right than you realize." He took a breath. "We had only scratched the surface of understanding Donovan's research when we confronted him." She reached upward with a slender hand, pushing her glasses further up her nose.
Go on.
Well, you remember those strange words that Adon was using for his spells? I think each word, possibly each syllable, really, corresponds to some sort of function. I don't want to go so far as to say the sounds have intrinsic meaning, although they might, but something is capable of interpreting them and producing results.
This explanation wasn't completely new. They had speculated the possibility when they had confronted Donovan, even though it sounded completely contrary to typical sorceress theory.
Right, but we've both tried using the same words he did. Repeatedly in my case.
Her lips contorted in frustration.
They don't do anything on their own.
That's where I've made a bit of progress. Do you still have the ring he was wearing?
And that gemstone?
The question was a probe for information, but it was only fair. What she was asking him about was even more valuable. The knowledge sorceress nodded.
Yes, and I've spent some time studying them. Initially, I thought the ring was the power source for those unusual flame spells both he and Verudin were capable of using, but the phrase he used doesn't activate the ring like I expected it would.
That, Jonin smirked, is because he was changing the function of the ring.
Lydia raised an eyebrow.
Go on.
So, remember when we talked about the marks on artifacts potentially corresponding to different words or concepts? Adon realized that if he could connect with an artifact, he could add additional words to change or activate a specific function.
Like adding keys to a Dominion sorcery spell.
Lydia nodded, a thoughtful expression on her face.
That's the point of all those Dominion marks he was putting on Verudin, and, presumably, on himself. When one of them activated a Dominion mark, it would send a command to an artifact the mark was linked to. Their words would determine the exact function. It's possible the marks even sent some sort of default message if they were silent. The notes in the journal were not that specific.
Lydia turned her eyes skyward.
So if we wanted to create the same effects, we'd need to be able to create identical bonds to the ones he did, meaning we'd need access to the same artifacts and to know exactly how the marks were constructed, and then use the exact same words. That sounds somewhat challenging.
He was tempted to tell her about the freshly burned mark on his right bicep, currently concealed beneath his nondescript brown tunic, but he decided against it. She had probably been bright enough to guess that he had stolen the Heartlance after their confrontation with Donovan, but she didn't need to know that he was able to tap into its abilities. She already knew far more of his secrets than he was comfortable with.
Yes, he said after a moment of hesitation, but not impossible. I believe I have sufficient notes to attempt making a mark corresponding to the ring you have, but I do not have the resources.
Dominion essence corresponding to the dominion of the artifact, I assume?
Lydia asked in a rhetorical tone.
I could probably arrange for that, provided you're putting the mark on me, of course.
He nodded affirmatively.
That would be acceptable. I think we could gain some valuable information from testing the interactions between a mark and that ring. Donovan's notes were impressive, but not exhaustive.
And as you suspected when we last discussed this, I believe he was expanding his vocabulary of terms that the artifacts recognized with each one that he studied. If you could convince Talion to let us study the Sekhes,
Lydia folded her arms, tilting her head downward with a frustrated expression. Jonin raised his hands defensively.
Hey, I had to ask. You Cytirans do love knowledge, so I thought.
Studying a sacred artifact amongst our own is one thing. I like you, Jonin, but you are literally a spy for a foreign government.
He rolled his eyes.
Well, when you put it that way...
If I asked you to loan me Valian's personal weapon for some research, how would you react?
Jonin scratched at his chin.
With amusement, really. I mean, do you really think I'd have any access to that? It's not really a comparable scenario.
Fine, fine. But it does sound ridiculous, right?
Well, if I did have access to it, I would try to at least entertain the idea.
Lydia sighed.
Ultimately, it's up to Solaris, but I'd advise him against it.
Jonin furrowed his brow.
Solaris? I've never heard you call Talion that before.
I've had to get into the habit. Calling himself Talion was one thing in Orland, but here, it's more than a little presumptuous.
Their mutual friend had always referred to himself as Talion, as long as Jonan could remember. It was the title of the sacred weapon he carried. Taking a title as a personal name wasn't exactly uncommon, but since the sword was a key element of the Taos religion, using the name in a Taos-worshipping city was essentially telling people he was a messenger of the gods. Which, given the swordsman's capabilities, Jonan suspected might actually be the case. He had watched bouts between some of the most skilled fighters in Sullyer, and less than a handful of them came close to Talion's raw speed or strength. And that wasn't even accounting for his ability to manipulate metal, which was so useful in a sword fight it seemed almost unfair. He had only heard the name Solaris, which was apparently Talion's actual birth name, thrown around once or twice. The swordsmen didn't seem particularly fond of it. "I guess I'll keep that in mind if I run into him. Is he going to be in on whatever you called me here for? I'm sure you didn't ask me to come out to Velthrin just to discuss Donovan's nodes, as interesting as they might be."
"You're right. I did have another reason for talking to you. A more immediate concern than the notes, although I don't think you should underestimate my interest in them. An entirely new method of casting spells could have the potential to reshape our society."
Jonan waved his hand dismissively. He was well aware of the vast potential behind this Donovan's discovery, a concept he was calling artifact sorcery in his mind. And that potential was exactly why he didn't intend to share the full extent of what he knew with anyone, even Lydia. More dreadfully, he also knew that Donovan's research partner, a sorceress named Morella, most likely understood the concepts even more intimately than he did, and that she was more than likely currently plotting her revenge against everyone who had been involved in Donovan's downfall. Talion, Lydia, and Jonan were probably among the top entries in that list. "Yes, yes, sorcery is important. What's this more immediate concern?"
"Well..."
Her lips twisted into a frown.
"A young man was murdered."
"Murder happens all the time. Normal people should look disturbed at a revelation like this, however." Jonan gave his best simulation of a sympathetic frown.
"Go on." "About a week ago, a young woman came to the Paladins of Taos asking for a healer. She said her brother was bleeding from several places, and she suspected a sorcerous cause. My partner, Aladir Tethereal, was the first to make it to the scene. I can say without exaggeration that Aladir is the most powerful life sorcerer I have ever encountered. His ministrations, up to and including multiple Spark of Life spells, had no effect."
Spark of Life was one of the most powerful known spells in all of Dominion sorcery. It was a way of forcing a mortally injured body to restart its essential functions. Layman often confused it for being a resurrection spell, but Jonan knew it was merely a potent measure for treating life-threatening injuries. If administered quickly enough, it could reportedly even restart the beating of a failed heart, but Jonan had never personally confirmed that. He had never met a life sorcerer even remotely close to powerful enough to cast it, let alone more than once.
"Did your partner survive the attempt?"
he asked without thinking, contemplating the costs on the body of such an effort. Lydia nodded.
"Yes, but he's still recovering. I arrived to find him still trying, but the victim was clearly beyond saving. To save you a longer story, I investigated the scene and discovered a trail of Dominion essence of poison."
"Ah, yes. Life sorcery wouldn't do much for poison. Water would be better for that." He realized after speaking that his commentary might have come across as rude or dismissive of the efforts of Lydia's partner, but she simply nodded to acknowledge the point.
"I followed the trail and found a ritually marked area. It was designed as a two-way portal, marked with the largest piece of Dominion essence of poison I've ever seen. I say piece in the literal sense. It was solid, like a stone."
Jonan quirked a brow at that. Dominion essence usually was conjured in the natural state of the plane it originated from. For example, Dominion essence of stone was solid, and Dominion essence of water was liquid. The Dominion of poison had both liquid and gaseous locations that sorcerers could draw from, but no locations that were solid. That meant that someone had to convert gaseous or liquid essence into a solid, which was tricky business. Converting Dominion essence from one state to another was something of a hobby of his, which helped explain at least part of why Lydia had called on him. She probably didn't think he was a suspect. She hadn't known he was already in the city.
Or had she? Could she have discovered me somehow? Perhaps she made a spell to measure the current distance between our mirrors. It wouldn't be impossible. Gods, I'm getting paranoid in my old age.
In Jonan's case, old age meant almost 22.
So, you want me to take a look at the stone for you?
She shook her head.
No, that wasn't the idea, although if you could glean something from it, we can look into that. I'm going to be very busy between trying to investigate this murder and protecting the remaining members of the family.
You think the killer might strike again?
Lydia shrugged.
We don't know anything about the killer's motives, except the identity of the victim. Calceris Theus.
Theus? Like as in related to Edric Theus?
His son.
Jonan let out a string of curses. Lydia blinked rapidly, appearing confused by the display.
You're sure you want to get involved in this, Lydia? Edric Theus? He's a powerful man. He probably has the resources to handle this himself.
And, more importantly, anyone willing to pick a fight with Edric Theus is either colossally stupid or extraordinarily powerful. Given Jonan's luck, it was more likely to be the latter.
That's precisely the problem. Edric isn't in the city right now. And Nakane, that's his daughter, is fairly certain that this will end badly if he returns before we find the culprit.
Jonan tightened his jaw.
Well, that's just lovely. Will you help me?
An assassin killing high-profile targets? That could be the same man that Riala wants me to look for. Or we could just have two extremely dangerous assassins loose in Velfarin. That'd be even better.
The scribe pressed two fingers of his left hand against his forehead, anticipating the beginnings of a murderous headache.
Of course. Where do we start?
Chapter 10 Velis 4 The Subtleties of Conversation. On the morning after Velis completed her first test, she found a note in her bed. This was more than slightly disconcerting, given that whoever had placed it had been subtle enough to avoid waking her. The contents of the note were more worrisome.
Fellow soldier, I saw your signal. Your presence here was not anticipated. Cannot make open contact on discreet assignment. Expect significant collateral damage. Advise you to withdraw from Paladin trials. Potentially lethal danger if you remain active. Apologies. Will not contact again. S.
Velis carefully destroyed the note, keeping a single shred of it, a section marked with a few letters, for the possibility of using it with tracking spells or attempting to match the writing. Landon had the easiest access to drop something in her bed, since he shared her bunk, but she doubted he had written the note. Neither the shape of the letters nor the terse style matched his writing. The obvious answer was Sterling, since she had sent him a signal before, but that didn't mean he had been the one that had actually seen it. Given that the writer was insistent on not making open contact, she would have to investigate discreetly or risk angering her new contact. The letter referred to her simply as a soldier, which implied the writer didn't know who she was. That was potentially a positive sign. Unfortunately, the signature itself was too vague to give her any additional hints toward the identity of the writer. The overt warning within the letter was a dangerous sign. Whoever had recognized her sign was most likely affiliated with either the Thieves' Guild of Velraya or the Thornguard. Both organizations had a history of small conflicts with the Paladins of Taos, but she was not aware of any recent changes that would trigger lethal danger to Paladin candidates.
Can I warn an officer somehow without making myself a suspect? Probably not. And I won't be in any position to help my friends if I'm arrested, or if I leave.
Velis bit her lower lip, frustrated.
I need to figure out who sent this and pry for more information. I can't protect anyone with so little knowledge of whatever this impending doom might be.
She didn't even consider dropping out of the exams. It wasn't an option. She did, however, spend some time during the following week making preparations for several potential scenarios.
If I see any hints of danger, I'll tell Lan and Sal immediately. One of them can convey the message to an officer if necessary without referencing me as a source. Lan knows how to keep his mouth shut, at least. Sal, maybe less so. Shame, since putting Lydia on this might actually be a good idea if it wasn't so likely to get me into trouble.
For the next week, each of the other cadets underwent their first test, sworn to secrecy until the final applicant had completed it. They quickly fell into a routine of physical training in the mornings, classes in the afternoons, and combat exercises in the early evenings. It was relatively light training by Velis's standards, containing little of the psychological conditioning that most traditional military training entailed. The former Queen's Guard guessed that this was most likely because, like her, most of the other candidates already had some degree of existing military training. The conditioning exercises seemed to be more about gauging the current condition of the candidates than molding them into shape, and the combat exercises were more about team building than general discipline. The most important step of the process was clearly the testing, which was geared toward disqualifying anyone who didn't fit with the organization. And thus, by the end of the first week, the 12 original platoon members in Platoon 2 had dwindled to 9. Unsurprisingly, Talion and Landon had made the cut, as had the strange Dalaran girl. In spite of the restrictions on discussing test results, rumors were already rapidly spreading that Talion had come a hand's breadth away from failure. With the first week completed and the tests finally done, the applicants had finally been given permission to discuss the details of their own tests. A score sheet had been posted on the wall of each of the platoon barracks, and Velis had been amused by the results. She mentally noted the rankings of the people who interested her. The public rankings used a letter code, although she suspected that the paladin candidates were actually being given a numeric ranking that was being kept hidden to help foster more speculation and competition. The key indicated that the passing rankings normally went from A to C, with S being a rarer notation for exceptional performance. Rank D represented a failing grade for a particular test. There were no listings of D at this state. Anyone who scored that low early on was simply disqualified outright. She suspected that D ranks might be allowed to progress in later exams if their aggregate score was sufficiently high, but she wasn't certain.
Keldon Andis, rank A. Unsurprising, given his reputation. Susan Crimson, rank C. Apparently, military strategy isn't her strength. Asphodel, rank A. Apparently, she's got a good head on her shoulders. The Wandering War, rank A. Apparently, his name is applicable to wartime strategy. Jonathan Sterling, rank B. Interesting. I expected him to perform better. Velis Jaldin, rank A. Oh, that's a relief. Looks like I evaluated the situation correctly. Solaris, rank C. Ouch. Sal is going to need to pick up the pace. Terras, rank B. Not bad. B is probably a pretty typical passing score. Lyson, rank B. Same as the twin. Guess they think alike, too. Kolash, rank B. I would have expected the warriors to be better at tactics than their oracle. Landon, rank S. Now that's very interesting. Going to have to ask Lan how he managed that. I don't see any other S ranks on here at all. Teshwal, rank C. Barely passed. I'll need to look into that as well.
After gathering a bit of information from other cadets, Velis headed to the mess hall to discuss what she had heard. Velis took a seat next to Landon, putting her tray down and leaning across it toward Talion.
Heard you got your ass kicked by an illusion.
She grinned brightly.
That takes talent.
Talion rolled his eyes. The illusion was covering something that was solid. I'm still not sure how they managed it. Whatever that thing was, it was heavy, strong, and capable of teleportation.
Something made from construction sorcery, maybe?
Landon took a bite out of a chicken leg, shaking his head and setting it back down on his plate.
They wouldn't have to actually teleport it. The sorcerer could just dematerialize and move the construct.
Possible, given that I didn't actually have any way of telling what was real. Talion cracked his knuckles. Anyway, I won that fight. Construct or not, it ran away.
Oh, so you scared off the illusionary monster?
Velis gave a mock clap, smirking.
As always, your heroism is without equal.
Hey, at least I actually went for the objective. I hear you didn't even attack the city. Talion pointed a finger at her accusingly, while simultaneously lifting a cup with his other hand and taking a drink. Velis shook her head.
Of course I didn't attack the city. I lived there for years. I knew all about how the Battle of the Three Fords went. There was no chance of success in a direct conflict. The Asharan had the human army outnumbered, had better training, and had defensive walls.
Yeah, instead of beating my head against a wall, I looked at the broader picture. I think that's what they were looking for, the ability to identify when the odds are against you and how best to deal with that situation.
She shifted her weight, leaning against her left hand.
I took Fort Lyson to the north of Orlan, had my army wall up there and took prisoners. We offered a prisoner exchange for the prince. They turned it down, but our close proximity forced their army to take the field to try to recapture the fortress. That gave us the defensive advantage, making the battle vastly more plausible. I think we might have won, given enough time.
You might have won by attrition. I might have actually saved the prince. Talion sat up straighter in his chair. I think you're right about what the instructors wanted. But that doesn't mean the instructors have the right answer to the scenario.
Velis chuckled at that. It's a test, Talion. Part of the test is figuring out what the instructors want you to do. Fail at that, and it doesn't matter how creative your idea is.
The swordsman lowered his head, frowning.
Maybe.
Velis felt an unexpected and uncharacteristic pang of guilt at seeing his expression.
Hey, now. I didn't mean to...
No, you're right. You just gave me something to think about.
Velis turned to Landon, who was still eating with a mildly amused expression. You're looking smug.
He raised another chicken leg, making a circular gesture with it.
Well, I just find your lecturing a little silly, given that I outscored both of you.
Velis shrugged. I figure you probably did the same thing I did, but with a little better micromanagement, or with judges who liked you better.
Landon made a scoffing noise.
Not even close, Vel. I won the scenario.
She raised an eyebrow.
Won? I talked to half a dozen other people before I came here, including some full paladins. That scenario doesn't have a win condition.
It didn't until I made one.
She rolled her eyes.
Okay, Lan, I can tell you want to regale us with your epic story of struggle and triumph.
Actually,
he pointed downward at his tray,
it was remarkably simple. What am I pointing at?
A tray with food, dinnerware and a drink, she replied, trying to sort through his logic. What, you sieged them until they starved?
He shook his head.
I consider that, but it's even simpler.
Talion seemed to have cheered up, his expression having shifted from sad contemplation to a look of intent focus. You could be pointing at any of the component parts that Velis mentioned. The food on the plate might represent destroying supplies. The knife could represent assassinating key targets. The drink...
Gods! Did you poison their water supply?
Landon's expression brightened.
And we have a winner.
Velis leaned back, folding her arms.
That doesn't sound like the type of a strategy paladins would typically approve of. They would have had human and Rethri slaves in Orlan at that point in history. You would have doomed them as well.
That's why I used Lysinium toxin, deadly to Asharan, but it has almost no effect on humans in Rethri, aside from the possibility of rashes or some stomach problems. They didn't know about it at that point in history, of course, so using my knowledge might not have been considered fair. Apparently the judges deemed it a legitimate solution.
Still, isn't poison something they would consider dishonorable?
Velis tightened her jaw.
I might have been reading this whole organization wrong.
Oh, I didn't use it to kill the whole city. First, we encircled the city, like we would in a traditional siege. Then we gathered both the necessary supplies to poison the water supply, and this was the tricky part, the supplies necessary for a ritual to neutralize it. Then we sent them a messenger and told them about it and demanded that they surrender the prince, as well as all their human and Rethri slaves and hostages. In exchange, we would neutralize the poison and withdraw.
Couldn't they just neutralize the poison themselves if they knew about it?
They didn't know the materials necessary for the cure, and I made sure we kept the supply trains far away from our base camp and under extraordinarily heavy guard. Battle sorcerers, anti-scrying fields on the area, the works. They could have taken the time to test the water and tried to formulate their own cure, but that would have meant dehydrating their city and risking panic until they had a solution. and while they might have had one or two water sorcerers as slaves, Asharan sorcerers almost never learn water sorcery. They consider it one of the weaker sorcery types. So they wouldn't have enough sorcerers to make water for the city, or to attempt a ritual to purify the water.
I'm a little surprised they didn't just attack your forces directly, given that they apparently had overwhelming numbers.
Talion tapped the bottom of his knife on the table, looking slightly perplexed.
That wouldn't fix their problem. In fact, it might have made it worse. Isharan are extremely tough, but they still dehydrate just like we do. Engaging in battle would have sped that process up. We tainted our own water supplies with the poison too, so even if they seized our resources, they'd just end up killing themselves with it.
That's uncharacteristically devious of you, Landon.
She gave him a nudge.
I'm rather proud of you.
Thanks, he said, setting down the chicken leg. I don't know if it would have worked in reality, but the judges seemed to like the core idea. Even gave me this blue flag.
He reached into a pouch on his side and retrieved a cobalt ribbon, about a foot in length.
It's supposed to cancel out a red flag if I get one of those in another test.
Velis pulled her lips into a pout.
I didn't get one of those.
Well, you didn't get ranked with an S. I don't even know what exactly that means, but apparently I'm exceptional.
She groaned.
You're exceptionally full of yourself, at least.
You turned what was supposed to be a no-win situation for you into a no-win situation for the enemy.
That's pretty brilliant.
Talion set down his knife on his tray.
That's what I should have done.
Instead, I took a serious gamble, risking our success on my own proficiency.
To be fair, Velis scratched at her chin, I think your plan had some merit too, Talion. The team you brought in with you might have rescued the prince even if you had lost that duel. I think the reason that you barely passed was because you risked the Sakess. Some of the judges might have considered that sword more valuable than the mission.
It's just a sword, Talion mumbled almost in a whisper. It cuts well, but so do 100 others.
It's a symbol to people.
Landon gestured at the sword, which was sheathed on Talion's hip.
Like the Heartlance was back in Orlan.
Sure, I know that, but I don't think it's fair to treat it that way for a test about military tactics. The people in that army were not particularly religious, so losing it wouldn't have been a tremendous impact to morale. There were no other paladins there, and the sword itself was a minor tactical asset at best.
Talion frowned.
This goes back to what we were saying before, Talion. The tester is as or more important than the test itself. You have to get into the heads of the people running the exam.
She pursed her lips. Although, apparently I didn't do quite as good of a job as I thought I did, given that Lan managed to show me up.
You should be used to that by now.
Landon winked at her. Velis resisted the urge to stick out her tongue, settling for just staring at him for a moment before replying,
Only because I don't use my sorcery when we spar.
Usually.
Usually, she agreed. Gotta keep you on your toes.
Her former Queensguard partner rolled his eyes and then looked back to Talion.
Anyway, we all passed. That's the important part. We should do something to celebrate.
Drinks? I like drinks. You could buy me said drinks.
She gave Landon another affectionate nudge.
I think I've bought you enough drinks to last a lifetime, Vel. I was thinking maybe we'd go out to the city and do some sightseeing. I've heard they're going to give us a day off to do whatever we want during the cleansing festival.
You want to go sightseeing during the festival? Festivals are about eating and drinking, Lan. Possibly a few other things that you'll learn about when you're an adult.
She gave him an exaggerated wink.
Landon sighed. What about you, Talion? Any plans for the cleansing festival?
The swordsman shook his head.
Not really, but I might try to visit Lydia. I haven't seen her in a while.
Landon grinned.
I wouldn't mind seeing a bit more of Lydia.
Velis finally picked up her knife, cutting into her rapidly cooling chicken.
Well, maybe when the two of you are done courting the fair maiden, we can do something that's actually fun.
It's not like that with Lydia. Talion jabbed a piece of fruit with his fork. She's just a friend. A mentor, really, in some respects.
Uh-huh. Maybe for you.
Landon visibly blushed, as she knew he would. It was all too easy sometimes.
Anyway, I'm sure we can find time to do something as a group for the festival. Landon stammered, rapidly taking a drink from his cup afterward.
Great. I'll think of something.
You two are going to love it.
Velis cut off a strip of her chicken, grinning to herself.
Trust me.
Velis turned at the sound of footsteps approaching her from the right. Lieutenant Torrent paused, folding his arms across his chest and tilting his head to the side.
Better finish that food fast, Jaldin. You're due in the briefing room at 6 bells.
6 bells? That's less than an hour.
Yes, sir.
She gave him a crisp salute, which he lazily returned.
And pack your bags before you go to briefing. You've got a trip ahead of you.
Pack my bags? Was I just disqualified?
Velis frowned as she opened the door to the barracks. It was dinner hour, so she didn't expect anyone else to be there. Asphodel was in the center of the room, sitting cross-legged on the floor, a large piece of parchment spread out in front of her. She let out a mild gasp when Velis walked in, hastily grabbing the parchment and beginning to fold it up.
"You aren't supposed to be here,"
Asphodel mumbled, sounding more confused than accusatory.
"No one is supposed to be here."
"Finish dinner early," Velis explained, heading over to the large trunk next to her bed to begin gathering her things.
"Got a map for the next test?"
Velis caught Asphodel shaking her head out of the corner of her eye.
"Not for the next test."
"Well, now that's interesting. She's got a map for a future test."
"No need to be shy," Velis offered. "Your secret is safe with me. And if you wouldn't mind sharing..."
"No," Asphodel said.
"I cannot."
Velis raised an eyebrow as she laid out supplies on her bed. A backpack, 2 uniforms, a bedroll to attach to the backpack, a waterskin, flint and steel, a coil of rope with a grappling hook, an extensive medical kit, a packet of herbs for water purification, and a few other miscellaneous supplies. And of course, a scabbarded longsword and an eating knife. She was already wearing her good boots, and she had her quarterstaff leaning against the wall nearby. Once her supplies had been organized, Velis attached the bedroll to her backpack and began to change into one of her uniforms.
"Why? I won't tell anyone. It'll be just between us. You are not supposed to be here. I didn't see you coming."
Velis frowned.
"This has something to do with that oracle thing Teshval keeps calling you?"
"Yes."
"Not much for words, this one."
"Okay, so you didn't predict me walking into the room. Why is that significant?" She glanced over to Asphodel. The purple-haired Dalaran had folded up her map, and she was now standing straight up, gazing directly at, or perhaps through, Velis.
"I can't see you properly."
Velis paused, half-dressed, and turned to Asphodel, tilting her head to the side.
"You're saying I'm invisible?"
"Not in the way you mean. I can't see your path, your potential future."
The Dalaran frowned.
"It is disconcerting."
"She can see potential futures? That's disturbing, if it's true. I'm not sure if it's more disturbing that such an ability exists, or that I don't show up on it."
"Has this happened before?"
"Yes."
"Again, lovely answers."
"Right. How does your ability work?
Should I be worried about your inability to see me?"
Asphodel frowned slightly.
"I'm not sure. If you should be worried, that is. My ability... I am an oracle. Your people might call it the sorcery of destiny."
She raised an eyebrow.
"Destiny sorcery? That's one of Cytira's gifts, or some such, isn't it?"
"Your people believe it to be so. It is a rare and special gift. My people believe the power of foresight. The gift of the oracle comes from Calrissia, the Maiden of the Stars."
She'd never heard that name before.
"Some ancient, mostly forgotten goddess, perhaps? Or just an alternate name for Cytira from another culture?"
"Is that what you believe?"
"No."
"Helpful. Real helpful."
"All right. Well, what does your lack of ability to see me say to you?" Asphodel moved back toward her own bed, slipping the map under her mattress and then returning to look at Velis.
"I cannot predict your actions. At least, not in the long term. When I gaze at you directly, I can see a few moments, but no more."
"Interesting. I need to do some research on this destiny sorcery. If it's real, that could be a tremendous asset, or an incredible liability to my plans.
I need to make her mine.
Well, that should make things more fun, won't it? Velis gave a grin. It must get tiresome being able to predict everyone else's actions in advance.
Not everyone else,
Asphodel corrected.
But yes.
Seems like you might benefit from having a friend to talk to.